Okay, we're out.
Everybody go.
Okay, honey.
You're hearing Kira Johnson saying goodbye to her family before getting prepped for a C-section.
Hey, Mommy.
Hey, Daddy.
Hey, Langston.
Hey,
5 minutes away.
It's April 12th, 2016 at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles. Kira's husband, Charles Johnson, is filming this on his phone. He has since posted the video publicly on Instagram. At 2:30 p.m., Kira gives birth to a healthy baby. She stays in the hospital, which is standard practice after a C-section. Things seem normal. At least for now. But 2.5 hours later, Charles notices blood in Kira's catheter, which can be a sign that something is dangerously wrong. For Kira, it means that she's bleeding internally from a tear in her bladder caused during the C-section. Charles alerts the medical team, but they don't take Kira in for surgery until 10 hours later. By then, it's too late. Kira dies just after 2 a.m. on April 13th, less than 12 hours after giving birth, from an issue that could have easily been resolved by adding a few simple sutures. Kira's story became widely publicized after her death, with this video broadcast on major news networks. Her husband, Charles, has become an advocate around pregnancy-related mortality and has testified before Congress about this issue. I reached out to him multiple times, but never heard back. Kira was just one of hundreds of people who die due to pregnancy-related issues in the U.S. each year, and the official rates are growing. According to the CDC, the U.S. saw 7 deaths per every 100,000 live births in 1987. Now, the rate is nearly 4 times that. I had a close friend who nearly died after giving birth due to postpartum hemorrhaging, and then I found out another friend went through a similar medical ordeal. That's when I looked up statistics around pregnancy-related mortality. And what I found was shocking. So I wanted to dig into some of the reasons why these rates are so high in this country. I interviewed expert researchers and care providers to learn about how they're getting to the bottom of this issue. It turns out, the answer is complicated. The first thing I discovered is that there are outside factors that are confounding the data. Dr. Neil Shah is the chief medical officer at Maven Clinic, the world's largest virtual clinic focusing on women's and families' health.
You can't fix what you aren't seeing, and you can't see what you don't measure accurately. And it wasn't until relatively recently that we even knew that as a country, maternal mortality was going up, and it was because we weren't systematically tracking it.
As assistant professor at Harvard's medical school, Dr. Shah spent much of his career researching and advocating for maternal health. What he's referring to is the fact that we don't have an accurate picture of pregnancy-related mortality in the U.S. before 2017. These days, we have a series of checkboxes to indicate pregnancy status on a death certificate. But those checkboxes didn't appear until 2003, and they weren't rolled out by all states at the same time. Lauren Rossen, senior scientific advisor at the National Center for Health Statistics, suspected that the gradual adoption of the checkboxes across the country contributed to the dramatic rise in rates of pregnancy-related deaths. She published a study in 2020 that examined this question.
The checkbox had a substantial impact on maternal mortality rates, effectively almost doubling maternal mortality rates. So the implementation of the checkbox kind of across the U.S. Resulted in about 9.6 more maternal deaths per 100,000 live births being identified.
I was astounded by that number. But Rossen also acknowledged that the checkbox doesn't fully account for the dramatic uptick in pregnancy-related deaths. The trend started far before the checkbox was implemented. The rate of pregnancy-related deaths doubled between 1987 and 2000, and the rates have continued to rise since all states implemented the checkbox. So while clearly some of the rise we're seeing in the rates of pregnancy-related deaths may be due to a data collection issue, that's also far from the full story. Dr. Shah offered some other telling statistics.
If you were to pick 3 statistics to explain the state of childbirth in the United States, it's that moms are 50% more likely to die in childbirth than their own mothers. Over the same period, full-term infants are 0% better off, and yet C-section rates go up by 500%.
You heard him right. The rate of C-sections has gone up by 500% since the 1970s, even though C-sections are associated with higher risk for complications such as bleeding, uterine rupture, and cardiac arrest. Several studies have found that it could increase chances of mortality by 60%. So why are so many hospitals performing them? Dr. Shah says part of the explanation is legal. A doctor is almost never faulted for performing a C-section. Another reason is that hospitals are economically incentivized to perform more C-sections.
On average, a hospital gets paid about 50% more per delivery for a C-section. And it turns out, from a cost perspective, a vaginal delivery is more expensive because it takes longer for people to be in labor. I've never actually seen a labor and delivery unit anywhere in the country that has a glut of resources. Usually they have just enough rooms to get by, just enough staffing to get by. And when you're really resource constrained, you know, one way to try to solve the problem is to move people through faster. And, you know, C-sections are the most obvious way to do it.
And hospitals across the state are feeling the pressure of constrained resources. In California alone, 9 counties don't have a single OBGYN. But the rise in C-sections is an international trend. And as of 2019, the U.S. is one of only 3 countries, the other two being Afghanistan and Sudan, seeing a rise in maternal mortality rates. So what else might be contributing to the rise in pregnancy-related deaths in this country?
Louisiana, about a third of our population is African American. African Americans have a higher incidence of maternal mortality. So if you correct our population for race, we're not as much of an outlier as it would otherwise appear.
That's Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana speaking to Harvard School of Public Health on May 19, 2022. In case you missed it, the Republican senator essentially said that maternal mortality rates in Louisiana are pretty good. That is, if you don't count the deaths of African Americans, who comprise a third of the state's population. We can't talk about maternal mortality in this country without talking about racism. Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely than white women to die due to pregnancy-related issues. And that's even if you factor in things like education status. The CDC has acknowledged both structural racism and implicit bias as playing a key role in contributing to disparities in the rates of pregnancy-related deaths. I'm going to walk you through how these factors can show up. Let's start with structural racism. Here's Shauna Cox, Associate Director for Science for Reproductive Health at the CDC.
The disparities that we're seeing by race in the rate of pregnancy-related deaths really may reflect the intersection of interpersonal racism and implicit bias, as well as structural racism. So things that manifest, such as residential, economic segregation, these are all linked to worse health outcomes. And as we see income inequality and other structural indicators of health widening, we know that these are contributors to pregnancy-related deaths.
Dr. Andrea Jackson is the chief of obstetrics, gynecology, and GYN subspecialties division at UCSF. She explains how the resulting income inequality can play out somewhere like the Bay Area.
For example, in San Francisco, the median or the mean income for whites and some Asian groups, $100,000 per year. Do you know what it is for Black people who live in San Francisco? $45,000. How are you supposed to be healthy when you're just like trying to survive? You're really just trying to survive.
And then the income disparity has a cascading effect. Lower income people are more likely to rely on public health insurance. Here's Dr. Shah again.
There are a number of things about the way healthcare works in our country that are not just insensible, but cruel. I think one of the cruelest features of the entire American healthcare system is that in much of America, 2 months after having a baby, you can get the rug pulled out from underneath you and lose your Medicaid coverage. So, you know, if you're not insured, you can get access to Medicaid if you're pregnant, but then it goes away 2 months after having the baby. Now, a third of maternal mortality happens in that window.
It's also a period of time during which Black women are more likely to die than white women. Dr. Shah explains that structural racism has not only gotten integrated into public policy, but also into textbooks and the tools physicians use to guide medical decisions. For example, physicians up until recently used an algorithm to determine whether they think someone is likely to have a successful vaginal birth after a prior C-section.
You'd put in somebody's age, their weight, and like their race, and it would spit out a probability. And if you put that they were Black, it would drop the probability. And that was based on looking at historical data that said Black people were less likely to have vaginal deliveries, but it wasn't based on the reason why. The reason why is because Black people were less likely to be supported to have vaginal deliveries. And what it functionally ended up doing is making the problem worse because then, you know, people were subjected to unnecessary surgery because they were told they weren't going to be successful.
Implicit bias can easily creep into clinical judgment. And in fact, several studies have indicated that outcomes for Black babies improve when Black patients work with a Black doctor. Here's Shauna Cox at the CDC again.
We've learned, for example, from studies around infant health, that when Black physicians were in charge of the birth of Black babies, their mortality rate was cut in half. And when Black newborns were cared for by white doctors, they were about 3 times more likely to die in the hospital. But there was no outcome for white babies based on the race of the physician that provided care.
UCSF's Dr. Jackson has witnessed firsthand how having a Black doctor can potentially save lives. So she goes out of her way to advocate for patients.
So a lot of my Black patients have my personal contact, and they know to contact me if they feel like they're not being heard.
For example, one of her patients was having trouble getting a needed procedure from a hospital, which claimed she was not eligible.
But I knew that she was eligible. And I was able, you know, because I'm one of the leaders here, to facilitate one of our amazing high-risk OB doctors to perform the procedure for her. And she, both her and baby are doing great. And one of the things she always reflects on is that if she didn't have my phone number, she would have, you know, ended up having a stillborn at 22 weeks. She thinks about that a lot.
Sadly, racism in obstetrics and gynecology in the U.S. is not new. James Marion Sims, considered by many to be the father of gynecology and inventor of the speculum, conducted his research without consent or anesthesia on enslaved Black women. Racism has been a part of the field from the very beginning. So why might racial disparity in pregnancy-related mortality rates be growing? Dr. Shakura Kemet-Rosenwald is a second-year resident at the UCSF Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology who works with Dr. Jackson, and she offered one compelling reason. She says we need to consider not just the negative impact of centuries of intergenerational trauma, but also the impact current racial trauma can have on the body.
I used to think about the study a lot. There's actually one that was done right after September 11th, and it's on Muslim women, an Arab-identifying woman, in the context of being Muslim in America right after 9/11 from 2001. And what they find is that the preterm birth rates for these women get a lot higher, and they associate this with the stress of experiencing anti-Muslim racism in the country. And I think when we try to take what we can learn from that study and map it onto what's happening to Black women in this country, there's a reason that Black Lives Matter came to a point in 2020. You know, like, we've had an increasing amount of racism over the last few years in this country, and the country is trying to deal with it.
She points to the increasing visibility of violent racism, such as the police shootings of Black men in recent years. And she says she's seen the impact getting worse over time in her practice.
So things that I've heard from patients more recently, a doctor than I did as a medical student, is like a listing of the litany of names of Black men and boys who have been shot by police. And I'm telling this person that they're pregnant with a male fetus, right, an XY chromosome fetus. And the first thing they say to me is, Dr. Kemen, oh my God, how am I going to keep my little boy safe? Or to me, there's no way you spend an entire pregnancy thinking those thoughts and you don't have hypertension.
In fact, a 2019 study that tracked close to 4 million births in California between 2007 and 2016 found that Black babies born near police killings of unarmed Black men had lower birth weights and were more likely to be born preterm than their white or Hispanic counterparts. A study published in 2022 found that women were more likely to give birth preterm and develop cardiovascular disease if they lived in neighborhoods where complaints against excessive police use of force were filed. Vice President Kamala Harris spoke at the first ever White House Maternal Health Day of Action on December 7th, 2021.
In the United States of America, in the 21st century, being pregnant and giving birth should not carry such great risk. But the truth is women in our nation, and this is a hard truth, women in our nation are dying. Before, during, and after childbirth, women in our nation are dying at a higher rate than any other developed nation in our world. And when we know that for some women, the risk is much higher, when we know that, we should do something about it.
The question is what to do. Through my reporting, I came across three general areas that expert researchers and care providers pointed to as areas of intervention. The first is to get really clear about what we're dealing with, and I don't just mean the statistics. We need to call a spade when we talk about the factors contributing to the rise of rates in pregnancy-related mortality in this country, and that includes racism. And also,
I think that the thing that nobody wants to talk about explicitly, but I'll just say it, is that this is patriarchy, right?
I asked Dr. Jackson why she thinks there are so many stories like Kira Johnson's. When patients know something is wrong and plead with a medical team for help, but repeatedly get dismissed. Serena Williams famously shared her experience fighting for a CAT scan, which ended up detecting a hematoma in her abdomen and blood clots in her arteries. Graphic novelist Lucy Nicely wrote the book Kid Gloves about her struggle to convince her doctors to treat her for preeclampsia, a life-threatening condition that can develop during pregnancy. Dr. Jackson says sexist and misogynistic attitudes get embedded into medical settings from early on in training, especially in a field that was traditionally dominated by white cis men.
I think that even though we're women, we're seeped in this culture, this sexist culture in medicine, and we're kind of, you know, unconsciously taught to not believe women. Isn't that horrible? But I think that's part of it. I think that's a huge part of it. I think that's the heart of it, to be honest with you.
For Dr. Jackson, the country's failure to systematically measure the deaths of pregnant people before 2017 is an indicator of just how little thought is given to them.
When it comes to not collecting the data around maternal deaths, like that's an accountability issue that we have in the United States. I've heard the same things, and even when we are trying to get at some of our numbers locally as well too, it's the same thing about like who's keeping track, whose responsibility is for that. So it's frustrating, but I think it also goes back to how much birthing individuals are valued within the United States as a whole.
The tendency for healthcare workers to dismiss the concerns of women and pregnant people is so bad that the CDC launched a campaign just to get providers to listen to them. It's called the Hear Her campaign. This is one of the ads.
I knew with this pregnancy something didn't feel right.
I was scared. I was scared a lot of the time because I just felt like no one heard me.
I'm glad I didn't stop at no. And I'm glad someone finally heard me, someone finally listened to me.
Black women are more likely to die from pregnancy-related complications. Learn the warning signs and be the one to hear her concerns. Visit cdc.gov/hearher. It could help save her life.
According to Shah, the way a society treats pregnant people is an indicator of the society's inequities as a whole. He says we need to prioritize the health and well-being of birthing people, which hasn't been the case historically, or even now. During the time I reported for this story, the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade.
I think that maternal health is really a bellwether for societal health in general, and that's why every injustice in society shows up in the well-being of moms, whether it's racial inequity, gender inequity, especially in a post-Roe world, as you look across the country, geographic inequity. And then that statistic about maternal mortality going up, I think it speaks to this idea of generational inequity as well, which may even be part of what Build Back Better and Make America Great Again are kind of tapping into as a public sentiment, that hope and opportunity are eroding in our country.
The second area we need to address is confronting structural racism. Some legislative changes are already underfoot. In October 2021, Gavin Newsom signed the California Momnibus Act, which extended postpartum care coverage under Medi-Cal. It also includes initiatives to address income disparity, including increased supplemental income and a guaranteed income pilot for pregnant people. The act also incentivizes midwifery schools to recruit from underrepresented populations. More locally, San Francisco Mayor London Breed, in partnership with the Black-led Collaborative Expecting Justice, launched the Abundant Birth Project in 2020. The program, the first of its kind in the U.S., provides a monthly $1,000 income supplement to Black and Pacific Islander women for the duration of their pregnancy and for 6 months postpartum. The third area is to challenge interpersonal racism. Anti-racist training in the curriculum could address implicit bias and also the ways that racial categories are used to determine treatment and who is being privileged in those textbooks. Here's Dr. Kemet Rosenwall again.
I always pay attention to what's considered to be default or normal, right? So a lot of the textbooks we look at, it's all based on white male bodies. Every photo you see is of a white male body, and that's the default, right? So even if it's not being said out loud, you know, the subtext is that what is normal, what we study, the bodies we are trying to save are white male bodies.
But Dr. Jackson says representation needs to take place not only in textbooks, but also in leadership.
Diversifying the healthcare workforce is so vital, so important. And when I talk about diversity, yes, I mean Black and brown individuals. Yes, I mean folks who are native Spanish, Chinese, Mandarin speakers. Yes, I mean all those things. I also do mean folks who are current, former birthing people. I think when you have, and not just having them in the healthcare workforce, but actually having leadership and power.
In the meantime, in the face of the pregnancy-related mortality crisis and in a post-Roe world, some providers are creating medical spaces designed to counteract these racial disparities, starting with Black women. It's a model called race-concordant care, which means that patients work with providers who share their racial identity. Dr. Jackson has been working on building a space like this for the past few years at UCSF. She founded the Embrace program for Black birthing patients and their families, which integrates behavioral and mental health services throughout pregnancy and up to a year postpartum. Dr. Jackson says that the experience of having a Black doctor can be a powerful one, like for one pregnant patient she cared for.
One of the things that I remember the most is like walking into her room before we were going to wheel her to the operating room to do her C-section. And I walked in and she had generations of family members in the room. And when I walked in, they all clapped. And I was like, why are you clapping? And they're like, this is the first time we've ever seen a Black doctor before. Our patients are so scared, so nervous. They know about these numbers too. So when they come to us, the sigh of relief that they have is audible from them, from their family members.
The program has had excellent outcomes. Whereas nationally, the rate of C-sections for Black women has been 35%, for Embrace participants, the rate has been less than 15%. Embrace participants, on average, have also been more likely to deliver full term. And the program has close to a 100% breastfeeding rate at 6 weeks postpartum, compared with the national rate for Black women, which is 60%. Apart from the rates of pregnancy-related mortality, other successes of the Embrace program are less easy to quantify. Dr. Jackson says one of her proudest contributions has been being able to allow Black women to hold on to the joy of the birthing experience, in spite of all the risks.
I know it's scary, but we have been giving birth under worse circumstances throughout our existence in the United States. And there's no reason why we can't do it now. I would really encourage them to do their homework and find a practitioner that they feel listens to them and values them, and to trust their gut and to really, really focus on the joy of growing their families and of bringing new life into this world, because I don't want that to be robbed from us, the joy.
For KPFA, I'm Lauren Shapiro. The music in this story is from Blue Dot Sessions.